Unstoppable Sound Agency. Welcome to this edition of Move to Amend Reports, where we connect you with activists and organizers working on the front lines of the democracy movement to bring you the lowdown on corporate rule, corporate personhood, and money as speech. This is the space to find info you need to help pass the We the People Amendment and legalize democracy. I'm Egberto Willis, and
I'm Laura Barnum.
Coming up next, we have with us today Jerome Scott, our Move to Amend National Board member and co-founder of Project South. Jerome is joining us to talk about the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, its contributions, and the lessons today's revolutionaries can learn in our own movement. We'll get the ball rolling after a quick public service announcement.
To learn more about corporate personhood, money as protected political speech, and how to get involved with Move to Amend, visit movetoamend.org. Don't forget to sign the petition and join over 400,000 people supporting the We the People Amendment at movetoamend.org/motion. You can also text the word sign to 707-656-4019.
You are listening to Move to Amend Reports, where we bring you the voices from the movement to amend the Constitution and abolish corporate rule.
In this episode of Move to Amend Reports, we talk with fellow national board member for Move to Amend and our good friend, Jerome Scott. Apart from his work with Move to Amend, Jerome is active in grassroots global justice and other social justice movement organizations, including the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. A labor organizer in the auto plants of Detroit in the 1960s through 70s, and a community organizer, popular educator, and author in the South since the 1970s, Jerome was a founding member and former director of Project South Institute for the Elimination of Poverty and Genocide in Atlanta, Georgia. He is author, co-author of numerous chapters and articles on race, class, movement building, and the revolutionary process, and is a contributing editor to four popular education toolkits, including The Roots of Terror and Today's Globalization. Welcome back to the show, Jerome.
Glad to be back with y'all.
Well, Jerome, you know, as usual, it's always great to have you on because you're always a source of a hell of a lot of information. So look, let's start this way. You know, white folks just don't know much about Black American history, which is unfortunate indeed. So we are really happy to have you here as co-founder of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers to discuss its relationship to our goal of building a democracy movement that includes us all. But we're going to have to start at the beginning. So what led to the formation of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers? And considering the labor unions were where we're at now, nearing their apex at the time, tell us a little bit about the history.
Okay. So, you know, it wasn't until World War II that a lot of Blacks were recruited and brought into the auto industry in Detroit. And then after the war, there was this tremendous influx of Black workers into the auto industry of Detroit. And so if you think about it, Black workers en masse began to enter in the main in the 1940s and 50s. And in the 60s, when my generation began to join the auto workforce, there was a significant number of Black workers, particularly in the Chrysler Corporation. And that was because Chrysler was one of the only one of the big three at that time, you know, Chrysler, General Motors, and Ford, that actually had a concentration of plants in the inner city of Detroit. And so we found ourselves, you know, in the plant, in the lowest paying jobs and the hardest working jobs, the most dangerous jobs, you know, it was a hell of an experience. I mean, they were good paying jobs, but like I said, they were the worst jobs in the plant. And, you know, and Black workers were being fired at will, being disciplined at will. And so basically being treated like third or fourth class citizens or third or fourth class workers in these plants. And consequently, we began to organize. You know, the first indication of a real organization of Black workers was in 1968 with the advent of DRUM, the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, at Dodge main plant in the heart of Detroit. And that was also the beginnings of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, was that Dodge main organizing. And it started off with a wildcat strike. You know, workers had just gotten so fed up of the conditions that they were faced with, on the one hand, by, you know, the plant managers and the supervisors, but we were also upset because we weren't getting any support from the union, from the UAW. You know, it was a situation where we not only had to fight with the company to better our working conditions and get safer workplace stuff, we also had to fight with the union to actually represent us. So it was a two-pronged sort of struggle from the very beginning when we began to organize. We knew that we were not only organizing against the company, but we were also trying to organize to get the union to do the right thing for its workers that happened to be Black. So it was a combination of the history of us just being integrated into the industrial process at the auto industry and our union not representing us and working conditions getting worse and worse and worse every minute. That was the backdrop for the organizing of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers.
Now, it's interesting because what the unions are just a group of folks working together. And the same cancer that you have within society at large is the same cancer you can actually expect to occur in the union. So I think to paraphrase what you've actually said is that in effect, the same problems you are fighting outside of the society itself outside of the corporations itself, you actually face within the unions. There was racism within the unions. So that's the reason why you as a group of, let's say, Black workers had to organize yourselves moving forward. Am I correct?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, every structure in a capitalist society, every structure, whether it's a corporation or whether it's a union or whether it's a city or a state, every institution, every organization is a reflection of the problems that, you know, capitalism presents us with on a daily basis. You know, racism, white supremacy, male supremacy, and you know, the whole gamut of problems, yes, is reflected in the unions as well as every other institution.
So I just wanted to kind of hone in on this a little bit because it's disturbing. So in other words, as Black workers went into the workforce in Detroit and into these plants and were hired, you went into the system and you became union members. You were charged your union dues. You counted as union members, but you basically lacked all representation within those unions. Do I understand?
You're absolutely correct.
Kind of like the Constitution, huh?
Yeah, kind of like what we're fighting, right?
On yeah, right.
A bigger picture, bigger stage.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, that's disappointing to hear. So I just wanted to drive that one home.
Given that this was also a period which saw many more women enter the workforce, what was the role of women in forming and organizing the League? Were they a major part of it? Did they have influence in it? Again, because in as much as this was one oppressed group within the union or forming a new union, we do know that in all communities, this isn't restricted to white communities, in all communities, women have been sort of relegated to a second class position. how did your movement, or how does your movement or that movement differ from the reality that women face in the 1900s and to some extent still face today?
Yeah, you know, this whole question of the role of women, I think it's critical because, of course, we're talking about the 1960s when the League of Revolutionary Black Workers was established, and we were infected with the same basic attitudes toward women, you know, and so we had to fight every day to make sure that we weren't doing to women what we were fighting against in terms of the corporation and the union doing to us, meaning that we had to really struggle with to make sure that we weren't discriminating internally against our women comrades. And, you know, there were lots of women involved. You know, the League had a student apparatus that was about 50% women. You know, it had the plant apparatuses, which were heavily majority men, because at that point, although there were some women in the plant, it was still overwhelmingly male. And then we had our community organizations that was more than 50% women. And so women contributed tremendously and to the development of the League. And it was a struggle to make sure that we fought for women's leadership to be relevant in the whole process. And you know, it was a struggle. It wasn't that we were you know, absolutely wonderful on the woman question. We weren't, you know, but I can say that we continued to struggle to make sure that women's involvement, both on the rank and file level and the leadership level, was fought for. And, you know, I can tell you that, like, in the community apparatus and the student apparatus, we had women in the leadership of those apparatuses all the way. But on the executive committee of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, there was 7 men and no women. And so we weren't perfect at it, although we struggled with it. But I think the most important lesson for revolutionaries today is that even though we didn't understand the big picture of the role of women and the oppression and exploitation that women suffer daily, what we did understand is that women were being treated wrong in the plants, and women were being not treated right in the schools and in our communities, and women had a role to play in that struggle, and we promoted that role. And I think today we have to make sure that we understand that women have as much experience and knowledge and understanding as any of us, and have to be critical in the leadership of our movement today. That's the lesson I think we learned from that.
I'm glad to hear that, because we're still trying to teach that lessons in the religious class, if you know what I mean. It is so difficult for them to come to that realization. Thanks, Jerome.
Well, I think we're still experiencing it in the presidential election as well. You know, there's got to be something to why people mistrust Hillary so much. You know, I mean, she's done a lot of bad shit, but Donald has done terrible shit. And, you know, for some reason, they seem still to be skeptical about a woman president in this country. So we still got a long way to go.
And we'll keep working on it. So
we better.
Yeah, we have to, because women like me won't stick around if it, you know, it's getting
exactly.
better.
Exactly.
It's getting better. What organizing principles were adopted that provided the impetus for including the word revolutionary in the League's name? You saw a need, you came together. What was the process and the principles that defined you and your mission and goals?
Well, you know, one of the things that I think that made us come to the conclusion that we had to be revolutionaries was this whole notion of fighting against white supremacy and racism. I mean, we realized back then that racism was, you know, and white supremacy was part of the fabric of this capitalist society. And one of the questions that kept coming up in our discussions about it was, how are we going to end it? And can it be ended within the confines of capitalism? And, you know, no matter how long we talked and no matter how much we struggled with it, we came to the conclusion that it was so integrated into the whole system and institutions of capitalism that it was impossible to actually overcome racism and white supremacy without overcoming capitalism. And to overcome capitalism, you had to be viewing things from a fundamental revolutionary change, not from a reform process. You're not going to reform capitalism. I mean, we have to have a new system. And that was really the thinking that got us to the point where we realized that if we were really thinking about resolving our problems, we had to be revolutionaries. We could not be reformists. And therefore, the name of the organization, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers.
You were young. You were a young man at the time that you were doing this.
Yeah.
But I assume that a number of the other members in the league were older than you too. You know, so it was this mixed age group. Was Malcolm X an influence? You know, the whole civil rights movement had been, you know, tearing the country up through the early 60s and that kind of thing. So some of these civil rights leaders, and I can't help but think of Malcolm X right now myself, mm-hmm. Was he an influence on your thinking and in moving forward in creating the league?
You know, Malcolm was from Lansing, Michigan. But a lot of his family in the 60s moved from Lansing to Detroit. And Malcolm used to come to Detroit quite a bit. And a lot of the people who were founders of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers were part of the organizing efforts to get Malcolm to come and speak at various venues in Detroit. So there was a direct relationship between some of the founders of the league and Malcolm. And so the answer, of course, is yes. Malcolm had a tremendous influence on us. And he had a tremendous influence on our discussions about whether or not we shouldn't teach ourselves and educate ourselves along the path of revolution as opposed to along the path of reform. And so, yeah, Malcolm was big in Detroit. And, you know, his whole speech on the ballot or the bullet was presented in Detroit the first time that he gave it.
Yeah.
And a number of us was at that speech. And, you know, that speech really turned a lot of our heads around, because what it said to us was we had to be broadly thinking about this process. We couldn't just think of this tactic or that tactic. We could use the ballot, we could use the bullet, and we could use everything in between. And so, yeah, Malcolm was very, very influential in our development.
So just a few minutes before a station break. So what were your basic demands, and were you effective in attaining them?
Right. Well, fundamentally, we had a program that basically called for equal representation in the union, as well as equal representation in the leadership positions of the plant. You know, when I was in the plant, I went into the plant in 1966, and there was no supervisors that were Black in the plant that I worked at. And when I began to meet other people from around the city who worked in other plants, there was no Black supervisors in their plants either. But at the same time, there were no Black leadership union representation either. You know, the union didn't have any Blacks on its executive committee, and there were no Blacks that, which, you know, they were called stewards and committee men, were the ones that worked with and represented people on the line. There were a couple of black stewards. The committee man was the representative of the union that dealt with the whole plant. There were no black committee men, you know, and so our other demand was to thoroughly integrate blacks into the leadership structure of the union. Biggest demand was around health and safety. You know, one of the things that was constantly occurring in the plants back then was accidents and injuries of workers, you know, and that was the source of many of the struggles that, we involved ourselves in the league, you know, where things were just not maintained. You know, you had these overhead cranes that would carry heavy loads of steel from one machine to the next machine, you know, above the shop floor. In the plant I worked in, for instance, there were dead spots in the railing that the overhead crane ran on. So if it hit that dead spot properly while it was carrying a load, the whole connection would be lost and the load would drop.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, many times people had gotten injured as a result of that. And so it was a lot of our demands was around health and safety stuff. And, of course, we had wage demands and sick leave demands and vacation demands and stuff like that. But those three areas, the union with representation, the company with representation, and health and safety were the main three pillars of our program.
And were you effective in beginning the transformation for more leadership and better safety?
As a matter of fact, we were. I mean, this is interesting because, you know, the league started in 68 with Drum. By 1970, 71, we had really begun to see some advances with, you know, blacks being elected to local presidents of local unions, blacks being integrated. You know, we had a couple of blacks on the executive committee of the UAW. The same thing was true with the company. You know, we got foremen and supervisors hired as blacks. And you know, in 71, we began to look at this. The thing that had not changed was the health and safety conditions in the plant. You know, so
right.
We got the black representation, but our workplace, you know, in terms of how safe we were and how our grievances could be positively resolved, didn't get better at all, even though we had black representation. That was when we began to challenge to ourselves whether or not we had the proper program. So we were successful on the one hand, but you know, we like to think of it as we were successful in form, meaning we got some black faces in there, but we were not successful in content, meaning the actual workplace didn't change that much.
And we'll pick up this conversation after a quick public service announcement.
You can support Move to Amend reports and other Move to Amend programs by joining our $28 for the 28th Amendment monthly sustainer campaign. Pledge $28 a month and help make the We the People Amendment our 28th Amendment to the Constitution. Visit movetoamend.org/donate to sign up.
Are you part of a faith or ethical community whose values and principles are being violated by corporate actions? We the people of the Move to Amend Interfaith Caucus share in common a variety of values and principles. In this unity, we find the short-sighted and single-minded drive for profits by certain corporations has led to the degradation of the environment and our society. Corporate power has come to dominate our existence, with the values and principles we all hold dear being routinely violated by powerful corporations using their so-called personhood to influence elections, legislation, regulations, and judicial outcomes in their favor and at our expense. It is the purpose of the Interfaith Caucus to engage faith and ethical communities and educate about how the work of ending corporate rule can be approached from a spiritual, ethical, or religious perspective. Working together at national, state, local, and faith community levels, we can pass the We the People Amendment. Join us on our monthly calls the third Wednesday of each month at 12 noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern. Visit movetoamend.org/interfaith-caucus for more information.
You're listening to Move to Amend Reports, where we connect the dots between the current issues of our time and the nature of corporate rule. We're talking to Move to Amend National Board member Jerome Scott about the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. Now, back during that time, Jerome, there was no 24-hour news cycle or internet to connect us like there is today. But that's not to say corporate media didn't have an outsized influence compared with local publishers. How did the League deal with the media back then?
That was one of our, I would say that was one of our best successes, because what we did was we had rank and file media. Every plant that we had an apparatus in would put out a flyer at least twice a week and be distributed both inside the plant and at the gate as people were coming to work, you know, talking about the problems that was facing the plant and talking about what we should be doing about it, and basically organizing ourselves through these leaflets and flyers that we would put out in the plant. And then at the same time, we had a citywide newspaper called the Inner City Voice that was published in connection with Wayne State University there in Detroit. You know, we had some friends that had actually taken over that paper, the editorship of that paper, and was publishing it with reports from what was going on in the plants, what was going on in the communities in Detroit, you know, and what was going on in the schools, particularly the high schools. So we had our plant level conversation, we had our citywide and community-based communications, and then we also developed something that was called Black Star Publications. You know, where we were publishing books. We published several books. Mainly, I guess the biggest book was called The Making of a Black Revolutionary by James Forman, which Black Star Printing published. So the way we dealt with the media was by starting our own. We had a profound distrust for the media. And that was really based on the fact that they never, you know, when we were giving them interviews, we could never see any truth in what we saw on the news that was reflected in our interview. You know, they just said what they wanted to say. And so we had that profound mistrust for them, so that our only option was to start our own.
Well, I can tell you that that distrust was definitely justified. And it's not just then, it is now. And to some extent today, it's actually worse.
I know. And that's one of the lessons that we do. I mean, we have got to have our own media, you know, because they're not going to tell our story. And, you know, that sort of gets to the point of the project as well, which I'm sure we'll get to in a minute.
And now, before, I just want to make a mention to all our listeners about something about the media and how you have influence. It is not an accident right now that if you take a look at what's going on one of the biggest media platforms right now, social media, Facebook, that just in the last few weeks, they have throttled down pages that put out information, all kinds of information. And the trick that they use is to say that, well, we're trying to keep news among friends and families. In other words, they're trying to prevent real messages from individuals for getting a broadband access outside of your own insular framework. So the media then was bad. The media today is worse in that they have a whole lot more control in the way they can get to people. And your time was a whole lot of paper. Now it's electronic and they own the pipes.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing that I think it would be interesting for the audience to know or hear, you know, back then there were about 10 times as many media outlets as it is today. Today, we only have a very few media outlets. You know, it's really been centralized. You know, so you don't even have the choice of going from one paper to the next and trying to figure out whether you got a different set of ears listening to you. You know, for the most part, the media has the same set of ears listening and the same voice coming out, no matter what the name of that paper might be. And that, I think, is really critical in terms of the media response to us today.
Very good observation, Jerome.
And you mentioned the project, so let's talk about that project, Jerome. You're currently raising money, and I donated to this project and recommend our listeners
sure
do
did,
the same.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. We're
still waiting on Roberto.
I wonder, where is Roberto?
I'm sorry, Edberto. Sorry
and,
about that, man.
And any, of course, anybody can donate. But yes. What you're doing is you're raising money to make a film to tell the story of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. So tell us about the film, the project, who's involved, and why it's important the story be told.
The League has had quite a few books written about it, you know, because when we organized Black workers, that was the first, we were the first organization to actually concentrate on organizing Black workers in industry. And so there's been a lot of books written about us, from Detroit I Do Mind Dying to A History of the League and so forth. But all those books and all that history was written by someone observing us, you know. And our project, we really seek to tell the story from the voices of the people who were involved in the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, you know, so that we can tell our story and make sure that we're not just trying to keep this in history. We want to extract the lessons learned so that revolutionaries today can learn from our experience and stand on our shoulders. And so this project was dedicated in finding as many of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers members as possible and interviewing them for that project. And so far, we have interviewed 50 of the members of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, and we're in the process now of editing that footage, you know, and it's a tremendous amount of footage. It's about an hour and a half for each interview and 50 interviews, so you can do the math. But really, it's telling the story from our perspective and trying to get people to understand that, you know, in that moment, we really thought it was possible to win. And therefore, we put everything into the work of the League. And you know, and it was a very, very educational and a great experience for all of us. And we want to share that experience with the rest of the world to make sure that this piece of history is not, you know, left to die and not to be heard of again. So that's the main reason that we're doing the project, is to get our story out. We have raised, you know, we were fortunate to get a $10,000 matching grant from the Diane Milliken Foundation of California. And so we've been struggling to raise the $10,000 in order to get the matching grant. And we've actually more than raised our goal, which is so far we've raised about $25,000. And so we're doing very well. Of course, to make a full-length film, it's going to take probably up $200,000. So we have a lot more to raise, but we're doing very well with raising the money. The other thing that we're going to do is to really do some political education. We have some themes in the interviews that we followed, one about the role of women in the League and the revolutionary process, the role of Black workers and why we concentrated on organizing Black workers, the role of political education, the role of theory and looking at the big picture, and the intergenerational piece, you know, because we had students, high school students that were part of the apparatus. We had workers in the plant that were young, you know, like me. I was 20-something years old at the time. And then we had workers in the plant that were, you know, in their 30s and 40s that were all part of the organization. So this whole intergenerational organizing has some experiences that need to be taught. So we're going to be doing these short political education pieces around those themes. And we're going to do, you know, give that to the world to look at. We're going to be going out and doing workshops around these themes and really trying to do some education political education as a big part of this project.
So that's what my next question was going to be, how you're going to distribute it. So you're basically trying to distribute it on an educational platform with panel discussion and that kind of thing. Watch the movie and have a discussion. Very cool.
Yeah, and the movie won't be done for probably another year and a half. So we want to use these shorts, you know, 5 to 10 minute short pieces to start that process off now.
What's the name of the film and how do people find more information about it online?
Well, there's a website that people can go to. It's called revolutionaryblackworkers.org. Revolutionaryblackworkers.org. You can go there to make a contribution as well. You can also go there and you will see some of the interviews that we've already put up on the website that people can, they're uncut, you know, they're the raw interviews, but lots of great information up there, both historical and present information. But that's the way to make contact with us. That's the way to donate to us. And the film will be, the working title is just The History of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. We're not sure, you know, and the subtitle is From Then to Now, meaning that we want to examine the history, but we want to make sure that people understand that that history does and can have an impact on how we think about our work today.
Before anything else, I just want to, first of all, give you some kudos for this great work. Secondly, I want to tell you, buddy, that your entire website spent quite a bit of time on my page that has a viewership of 24,500 people. So some of that money is from your page, probably came from that page as well. But
great.
Going to the gist of it, in terms of building the democracy movement and passing the We the People Amendment in both white communities and communities of color, what lessons can today's revolutionaries or social change agents learn from the League's history?
Well, two things, really. One of the things, the first thing that we emphasize, just about every interview talked about it, and that was the role of political education. That is, getting a better understanding of the world we live in. I mean, the thing that we need to do, people need to have a better understanding and a better grasp of, you know, the role that our so-called democracy plays and where the Constitution, what was the history of the Constitution and why that Constitution for this country was adopted at the time that it was and what role it plays today. I mean, political education really is critical with making any movement successful. Because the more people know about the problems that we're trying to resolve, the more thinking we will have go into the resolution of those problems. So that's the first lesson. The second lesson is that, you know, one of the things that we realized and learned when we began to do an evaluation of the League's work in 1971, and we found that we had been very successful on the side of getting blacks into the corporations and the union, but not on what was happening on the work floor. We realized that we had to organize much more broadly than just black workers. That organizing black workers was a good start, but if we wanted to really have revolutionary change in this country, we had to organize a lot more broadly than that. And that, I think, is a lesson that we have to really take into all of our work today. And that, you know, that we have to have a broad base among African Americans, among whites, among Latinos, among poor folks, no matter what their ethnicity is, you know, and that lesson we learned in 1971, and we've been practicing that ever since. But those two things, I think, are the two big ones.
And if those lessons are learned and applied in this movement, then we have a huge chance for success.
Exactly.
Well, we're almost out of time. And I want to remind everybody that to go to revolutionaryblackworkers.org to learn about the film project and to watch some raw footage and to make a donation. And Jerome, what final comments would you like to leave with our listeners?
Well, you know, we're living in very difficult times today. You know, this presidential election is going to be a milestone in the history of this country, one way or the other. You know, whether the Democrats or the Republicans get it, it's still going to be a milestone. But we got to be very careful, because this whole Donald Trump motion that's moving us closer and closer to a more fascistic society than a democratic society. Not that we're fully democratic at all, but Donald Trump wants to move us even further away from the limited amount of democracy that we have now. You know, I think that now more than any other time, this whole question of us organizing broadly and educating ourselves deeply is critical to everything that we do today, and particularly when you look at what's happening in the election process in this country and all over the world, really. I mean, there's this right-wing trend all over the world, and it's basically based in the fact that the capitalist economy is deteriorating rapidly. I mean, it seems like it's strong in some countries, but people are being left out economically every place in the world. And that's really what we're seeing reflected in these motions, that when people feel like their economic security is in peril, which many people do, then they turn to some way of trying to get back to the days in which they thought they were in control. And that's what Donald Trump is saying when he says, let's make America great again. He's saying, let's go back to a time when white males controlled everything. And that will be good for at least white males, but not for anybody else. You know, and not every white male at that, particularly poor white males, they never had any chance in this country. You know, so I just think people got to really think about that and really begin to organize and educate themselves. Because if we don't, we're going to be in real danger.
Now, Jerome, it was our pleasure to have you here on Move to Amend Reports. I'm sure that you'll be here many more times. I'm sure our listeners found your message quite insightful. In fact, it is something that many don't know about. It's something that many of us never knew about. So I think it's important so that folks can actually see that movements never end. It is ongoing. It is something that has to be nurtured. So it was a pleasure having you here. Thank you for being with us.
And I am always happy to be with y'all. You know, it's one of those programs that is indispensable for this moment of our movement. So keep it going. Bye-bye.
That's it for this edition of Move to Amend Reports. Thanks for listening and have a great week.
Move to Amend Reports was created and brought to you by Move to Amend. Produced by national team members Keon Bliss, Laura Bonham, Egberto Willis, and Caitlin Saposi-Belknap, with the assistance of Renee Babcock, and with contributions from Move to Amend staff and affiliates. Opening theme entitled Move to Amend, performed by Shimako Noble and produced by Soul Circuitry.